budget book and there's some tabs to help organize it.
Welcome to the committee and the members who are here. You get points for that. And thanks to the public who's here as well. We are continuing our maybe the last day of this project. Wouldn't that be sad, Ms. Bartolik? You'd so wish you could come back another day. We could arrange that, come back more days. We do have a pretty good number of pages to go through, but we do have some time for questions. And I forget how many pages there are in today's thing. There must be 15 or so, or is it more than that? Yeah, pushing 20 pages. So anyway, so why don't you start and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alex Bartolik. I am with the Department of Human Services, and I am going to start on page 46. It is labeled Reduce Certain Congregate Living Rates. There's about 3,500 people on the DD and CADI waivers who are living in corporate foster care or customized living settings who have less intense needs than other recipients, and the majority of people with similar needs live in their own home or other settings at lower cost. This proposal requires an adjustment in the services to be provided to these individuals, and savings is assured by a reduction in the rate that supports the services for people by 10% during this biennium and an additional 5% the following biennium. And I know you're just getting organized and started, but if you have questions on this proposal, I'd be happy to take them.
Questions, member? And cool, and I just want to commend the staff for their little tab filling. Now we have the cool little tabs here that at least one, at least one member, like they wore their fingers out sliding those little tabs in there. So that's really nice. So, hearing none, I guess you've you can check one off the list there, Ms.
Okay.
Bartolik.
The next one I'm going to speak about is on page 48, and it's labeled Disability Waiver Enrollment Limits. This is a proposal similar to what you have seen before. In the forecast, many people looked and saw a very large increase in waiver services. That's because the limits on the growth in waivers ends at the end of this biennium. So this proposal continues some of the current limits with one exception. It would continue CADI at 60 people a month. It would continue the DD waiver at a growth of 6 people a month, but it does reduce the growth in the TBI waiver to 3 people a month. And so there are ways for counties to manage their waiver dollars to be able to serve additional people if they can create efficiencies, but this is reducing the growth that they have given the current population on their program.
Actually, we'll come to order. So now we're official. Mr. Bartolik, is there a maintenance effort on some of these that we have to keep? And just can you give like the 30-second version of that?
Mr. Chair, there is a maintenance of effort on some of the spending. However, for this particular proposal, because it still allows growth in the program, it appears we would be fine with our maintenance of effort.
And is that based on dollars or people? Or both?
We have a question about that. It looks as though it's both, that we really need to maintain the number of people and spending that was in place earlier. But again, even though we have had restricted growth, we have had growth in the waivers.
And I think I'll want to know more about that privately later on.
So okay, we can
get you. You'll let us know. Representative Huntley. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Bartolik, could you go through again, if we put a limit on waivers, these are people that are already eligible for institutional settings. And so why doesn't that cost us more if they go into a higher cost area?
Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, it's true that the people who are eligible for these services have been found eligible to be in an institutional setting. Historically, people do not want to go into an institutional setting. They don't want to go to a nursing facility, or there may not be the appropriate capacity. And so they may access state plan home care services or look for other alternatives that may not be what they really need in the long run, but it can help manage some of their costs in the short run. And the page does project some admissions into nursing facilities.
Other questions? I guess you can keep going. Thanks.
Okay. We're going to go a little out of the order just to stay with some themes here. So the next page we're going to talk about is on page 56. It's titled Increase MAEPD, which is Medical Assistance for Employed Persons with Disabilities, their premium and cost share. And this proposal has a number of components to increase information, awareness, and support for employment for people with disabilities, because for many people, they can work and still maintain their benefits, and they help contribute to the cost of their services. This does propose increasing the unearned income obligation and also increasing the minimum monthly premium. And what we have found is that there are people on MAEPD who work a minimum number of hours, and by increasing the premium and unearned income obligation, it also actually has been an incentive, both in our own research and also nationally, to work a little bit more hours and being able to get to a point of contributing more to services.
Representative Hott.
Ms. Bartolik, will anybody be losing any coverage with MAEPD with this proposal?
Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hash, no.
Ms. Bartolik, how does it help by increasing a fee to help them stay on longer? Is that what this does?
We've
increased their share. Mm-hmm. That helps them stay on longer.
Mr. Chair,
need some help on that.
The MAEPD program, the Employed Persons with Disabilities program, is intended to allow to be an incentive and enable people to work and have employment and still maintain their benefits. And again, for increasing the premium from $35 a month to $65 a month, it's not that dramatic of an increase, and it will actually help people, give them an incentive to work a little bit more to help offset some of our costs and yet maintain the program. So it helps further the goal of the program.
Oh, I understand. Representative Hosh, did you want to follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Bartolik, will the income requirements change at all?
Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair,
and what I mean by earned income requirements?
No.
Okay. Representative Hosh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just an editorial comment on this program. I think there's probably no better or important or effective program. This allows people to avoid a very large spend down, to be able to work, to build up assets, to stay involved in the community, to be independent. And I just wanted to let people know that this is, MAEPD is just it's very important for certain individuals, and it makes a tremendous difference.
And Ms. Bartolik, so if going from 35 to 65 helps them, if we charge them 200, would that help them more? I mean, because they'd have to earn that. That'd be the fire that would drive them. Otherwise, they'd be. Is that part of what they're encouraged by? Just the need to get the money. Is that what drives them to work more?
Mr. Chair, I think that how much is the right amount before it becomes a disincentive to be on the program and just not work is also a factor. So this was selected. But for many people, they want to work. The economy is a little rocky right now, but there are people who are able to work extra hours and be engaged. So it's an important program for folks who want to be able to be contributing in their community and having meaningful activity and still be able to receive health benefits.
I appreciate it. So it's incremental. Representative Hosh.
And Mr. Chair, on that comment with $200, also remember that much of the employment done by these individuals isn't an employment that's making $7.25 an hour at minimum wage. They're making much less than that. But with the $65 income requirement, it's achievable, and it keeps people engaged, involved, and without having to essentially go into poverty so they can avoid a spend down.
Right, and I appreciate it. So I was just being a little facetious about if we could. Anyway, so like the tax discussion. Oh, we tax them more. That'd really help. We better move on before we get run afoul of this, Ms. Bartolik.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Held, and we will jointly go through a proposal on the surcharges.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services, Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. The surcharge proposal is a per bed per year health care tax that applies to, in the case of what I'm going to talk about, all licensed nursing home beds, and it's a certain dollar amount per bed per year. It currently is set at $2,815 per bed per year. We're proposing to increase that by $635 on July 1st.
Mr. Held, we have to interrupt this very important presentation for a more important announcement. You've attracted a group of people to hear your presentation. The Greater Mankato Leadership Institute is here today because of this discussion of surcharge. And I don't know how they knew that, but this is remarkable. I want to welcome them. We want to wave. Anyway, so thanks for coming. Glad to have you here. I didn't realize you had such a fan base, Mr. Held. I think that's pretty cool.
You've got me speechless, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lomer.
Could you tell us what page you're on, please, Mr. Held?
Oh. I believe this is page 54.
How can you break the moment?
What?
Never mind. What page?
Page 54.
Thanks.
I want to say something like, this only applies to nursing homes in Mankato. But it does apply to them as well as all other nursing homes. So it seems like these are odd numbers to say let's increase it by $635 and then 3 months later increase it by $350. Currently, federal law says that this tax cannot exceed 5.5% of the revenues of the taxpayer. Because it was last increased in the 2003 session and those revenues have increased over time on a per bed basis, there's room to increase it up to the 5.5%. And that's why we're proposing a $635 increase on July 1st. The federal limit goes up to 6% under current law on October 1st. And so we are proposing an additional $350. And those, you don't want to exceed that limit. The problem with exceeding the limit is fairly severe. But we are pushing extremely close to what we estimate that limit to be, about 4.49% and about 5.49% and about 5.98% on the nursing facilities. Associated with that increase in the tax is a rate adjustment to the external fixed portion of the rate of $2.17 on June 1st and $1.20 on September 1st. And that's because when they start having that higher rate in June, we pay them in July, and they get that approximately at the same time that they would have to make the payment to the state.
I have some questions. Other members have questions? Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Held, why is this tax implemented in the first place? What was the rationale behind it?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, the tax was implemented because as a permissible health care tax, the Medicaid, the payments on behalf of people with Medicaid can include monies to pay a share of that tax. So in other words, Medicaid is paying the tax on behalf of Medicaid residents. Private pay people are paying it, and so on. The Medicaid, the primary reason why the state initially wanted to do this tax was because the Medicaid payment toward the cost of the tax are half federal dollars and half state dollars. And so it was a way of leveraging federal funding. Most states do surcharges like this in some way or another. The general sentiment is, gee, it's great to leverage the federal dollars. We'd rather not tax the private pay. And the private pay do have objections to paying a tax, particularly when the money doesn't stay at the nursing home. However, if you were to try to create a hold harmless to protect those private paying people, then the tax would become impermissible. Any sort of a hold harmless makes it impermissible.
Representative Schumacher.
You said that private pay people don't want to have an increase in that because the money doesn't stay in their nursing home. What happens to the money that the surcharge comes in and the federal dollars when they come in? Where does that money go?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schumacher, there's a net benefit to this. There's a certain amount that comes in. There's a certain amount that's paid out in that rate adjustment. You'll see that on page 55. For example, in 2012, the surcharge would generate $28 million of revenue for nursing facilities and $9 million of costs. And the difference is the $19 million, and that goes to the general fund.
Representative Schumacher.
That's it for now. Thanks.
Okay, so Mr. Held, so the nursing facilities, do they have a net cost on this? The average one is not going to see that. The private pay people have a cost, but the nursing facility is not helped or hurt, basically.
The average Medicaid facility will come out even on this. If we were to structure it so that anybody who lost money on it, because, say, they had really high vacancies, we don't charge for occupied beds. We charge per licensed bed. So if they had a lot of vacancies or a lot of Medicare days or a combination, then the revenues they would collect from their Medicaid and private pay would be insufficient, and they would lose a little bit of money on it. On an average statewide basis, I've got a sheet of paper here, and this is the handout that was on the table, and I believe the members also have this handout. Looks like this. The statewide average result of this is a loss to facilities of 0.02%. I'd say that's pretty close to break even.
Okay. Representative Huntley.
I'll pass.
Okay. Any more questions about surcharge? Mr. Held, I think that we're going to have you stand away there for a little bit. We have some other of your colleagues that have, I think you get to be with us for quite a while here yet. So in honor of that, Mr. Benson, do you want to come down and do your piece? And then we'll do the mental health piece after that, and then we'll go back to continuing care. Hi, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members, thanks for having us back. Again, I'm Dan Starkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Our change item is on page 98 of the area. We also have a handout today that kind of gives a history of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and the budget as well as population. And when it gets handed out, I can describe that. But the page 98 talks about the Minnesota Sex Offender Program's growth population. The change item is strictly about the growth of the program. What it shows is that in fiscal year 12, we're gaining 50 former clients. In fiscal year 13, another 52 on top of that. And the change item really is based on some simple math here. It's the number of population that we're anticipating through projections, as well as what the marginal per diem, or the cost for only the new clients, are going to be, are $144 a day. And based on that, the change item is 2.85 for the first fiscal year and 5.84 the second fiscal year. And the state does get 10% of this back from the counties and the county share of their cost per statute. The chart that's being handed out is actually a really simple chart. It shows population is in the green. Our green line bar. It goes from 336 in 2006, or fiscal year 2006, to 735, what we're anticipating at the end of fiscal year 13. It also shows year by year what the our total budget is, appropriated budget. And at the top, it basically talks about each fiscal biennial year cost. So biennial year 06, 07 was $105 million, 08 and 09 was $146 million. Decrease in fiscal year 10-11 were the changes that we did to the program and the reductions that we had in our overall staffing and process. And you'll see the fiscal year 12 and 13 is $143, almost $144 million. That's still less than what the program cost back in fiscal year 8 and 9.
And for this member's attention, freshmen in particular, if you look at that blue little chunk there is stimulus money that landed. That would make the 10-11 numbers look artificially low if you just took general fund. So when you take the stimulus money and roll it back in, this gives you a more accurate view of what the budget really was. So as you interpret the math, that'll be helpful. Any questions about this? I do have one other question. And so if this is just a raw client increase, then you're going to do your bargaining within the appropriation and your health costs and all that gets done within a flat appropriation. Is that true?
Mr. Chair and members, the growth funding here is for all the anticipated cost around the new clients coming in. We have not factored in any inflation or any additional costs for bargaining or increases there. We've actually taken the 2010 costs for salary, and that's what's factored into the $144 per diem.
And so I know in the past, I mean, I'm asking a question I don't know the answer to, so I'm a little nervous. But since you're here, so do you expect at some point you'd come back with a supplemental budget request, or you're going to be doing your cost of living and all that within the appropriation that's there? I know it's gone that way in the past. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, in the past, we have been able to do that within the appropriation, and we'd make every attempt to do that as well.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. Any of us have a question? I think we're fully informed, and you can...
Mr. Chair and members, thank you again.
Thanks for your service, and good luck with your treatment program. Ms. O'Connell, you want to come down? And whatever crew you've got with you to... I think we have 4 pages to do in the mental health side, and actually we haven't had a chance to say hello to you, so if you want to take a minute and welcome you, and you can say hi to us, and take a couple minutes and...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maureen O'Connell, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health Services. And some of you know that this is my third week on the job. And so I'm hoping that by the end of this week that I have figured out all the important parts of the department, like where the bathrooms and the kitchen and all of those things are located.
Kitchen.
And I also hope I stop setting off alarms as I try to go through the gates without putting my tag through. I'm getting to know the security people well. Many of you know that I was previously with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. And I was the director of advocacy for 16 years. And my background is in healthcare policy, particularly expertise in the public programs. And so I've gone from an office of 12 to an office of hundreds, and am experiencing quite the cultural shock. So with that, we could turn to our budget pages. Our budget starts on changes start on page 94, and the first proposal was to tighten the chemical dependency placement criteria. And I'm not sure if there are questions on this page.
Yeah, we brought. Are you back? Because someone had asked to talk about this. Why don't you, since you're here, tell us if you want to review it or have one of your staff just kind of go over the highlights, so at least we'll, maybe that'll provoke the question that somebody had when they asked for this to come.
Okay. So I'll maybe turn it over to Bill Weiss from the chemical division, and he can go over this. Or maybe I'll just go over it briefly. What this provision does is it tightens the criteria for admission into the residential chemical dependency treatment programs. And what I understand is that we have a process called a Rule 25 assessment, where people that are presenting for treatment are assessed by this Rule 25 assessment tool, and previously, if you were assessed at a level 3 severity, there were some, there was an option within the rules to put you into either outpatient or residential treatment. And what this proposal does is it removes the option to for residential treatment for those with a level 3 severity. And but people with level 3 severity would still be entitled to outpatient treatment. And those, so then those with level 4 severity would receive, would still be eligible too for residential chemical dependency treatment. So this affects about 1,895 people will now be entitled to outpatient instead of residential treatment.
And is this run by the counties then? Is that where this assessment takes place? Can you just give me an update on that part? I'm just trying to get my head around some of these different programs.
Yes, the county does the assessing. And tribes.
And there's some talk, I've gotten all these advice from people on things, and they suggest that the assessment process is cumbersome and that the workers spend a lot of time filling out paper and not doing work. If I had some help on that topic as part of my budget, would that be considered friendly to you all? Or and do you have either on the record or off the record suggestions about how to make that happen? As your, some of your staff are making faces at me.
So Mr. Chair, members, of, members of the committee, I think I will have to turn this one over to Gene Anderson.
Good afternoon.
Welcome
Mr.
to the committee.
My name is Gene Anderson. I'm a supervisor at the Treatment Services at the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division for DHS. In response to that, we do have a couple of ideas regarding the process of assessment and how it can be simplified for clients and simplified for counties. However, it would be a major rule change, so we're looking at, if we're going to undertake that, we'd undertake that starting this summer.
And if we helped you out by just making a statutory change, would that be maybe a favor then? So anyway, just so you know, we can do statutes for free as far as you're concerned, not as far as we're concerned. And they go real quick then sometimes. And so as we try to fit more services into the same dollars, I don't know what you're, I know you're finding the kitchen and setting off alarms and all that, Commissioner, but some of those things, at least this chair is very open to that. And even if something gets half the way there, we could, you can complete it and come back with other ideas. So don't be shy about that. Other questions? Okay, well you've check
well,
that one off
Mr.
the list.
Chair, members of the committee, we will look forward to working with you on the on your proposals as they go forward. On page 95, the next proposal is to increase the county's share of chemical dependency treatment costs. And currently that county share is 16.14% for clients who access the consolidated chemical dependency treatment fund and are not enrolled in medical assistance. And this proposal would increase that share to 22.95%. And this issue came up in the Senate, so I'll mention it. We also think that with the new medical assistance expansion that's going to take place on March 1st, that this could offset some of the increased costs to the counties because there will be less people that are not on medical assistance. And so, and this share, again, only applies to those that are not on medical assistance. But we don't have the numbers yet.
And, Commissioner, is that an MA benefit then? If they're on MA, you get services independent of this fund? Is that right?
On this, when you're on medical assistance, then you get services through managed care.
And this is just the non-covered individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just remind me, what's the income limit for people to get access to the consolidated fund, if you know?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I'll have to turn over that to Gene.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, the current eligibility is federal poverty level as defined for MA. And for the consolidated fund, it's just the federal poverty level, which is, I think, about $12,000.
So 100%? Is it 100%?
Yes.
Okay. Oh. Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. And so what am I missing here? It sounds like everybody who would have access to that fund will have access to medical assistance or, you know, with very probably a few exceptions. Am I right? Or what am
Representative Liebling, it goes up to 75 with the early expansion, leaving a gap of 75 to 100.
Thank you.
And that's the population.
But
you can keep going.
Thank you. Thank you for reminding me of that, Mr. Chair. But ultimately, eventually, when we have the full expansion of medical assistance, this will basically pick up everybody, right? I mean, maybe with a few exceptions. I don't know if there's anybody, you know, who would not be eligible then for medical assistance that would be under that, under the federal poverty limit.
I'm
but
really confused.
It will take a big burden off the consolidated fund, I would think.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that is probably true, but we can get back to you on that issue in more detail as we see the numbers as the department develops those numbers.
Representative Liebling, I think when the forecast comes out on Monday, I bet if you looked at this program item, the tail should be close to zero for 014. For some of the members here, the expansion, we currently serve an array of people in medical assistance at different levels. The early expansion would cover everybody up to 75% of the poverty limit, which includes some 16,000 people not covered otherwise, and we shift 70,000 or whatever from Minnesota Care and the old GAMC program. And so then currently those, before the expansion happened, which is a couple days from now, they would be serving their chemical dependency needs by this fund if they weren't insured. And so now that there's going to be more of those individuals covered starting March 1st, they would get their chemical dependency treatment through medical assistance. Through their PMAT provider, leaving a smaller group left to get care through this program. So, does that help? Okay, maybe we'll quit while we're ahead on that.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, so what's the next page you've got?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next page deals with the governor's proposal to reduce state-operated services. And I'm going to have Mike Tesner, the director of state-operated services, come down and talk about this page and answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Tesner, it's been a while. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Mike Tesner. I'm the chief executive for state-operated services, Minnesota Department of Human Services. We operate the what was the state hospital system, now a specialty health system throughout Minnesota. The page that you have in front of you, what number is it?
96.
On page 96, this accounts for the reduction of what we have established in Wilmer, Minnesota, a subacute 16-bed program. This program initially, up until this past summer, was operating as a 16-bed community behavioral health hospital serving adults with mental illness in need of acute inpatient care. Last legislative session, we proposed modifying the array of services across state-operated services, including a change in this program going from an acute level to a subacute level. The proposal in front of you removes that subacute level from our services. It affects approximately 28 staff, I think 18 FTEs. The advent of this service was intended to reduce the number of individuals coming into our hospitals who would end up staying beyond the medical necessity in our hospitals. So in other words, we would have a step-down unit. Since the implementation of this model, both out of our Wadena site as well as Wilmer, we've seen a reduction in non-acute bed days of about 25%. So this model has actually achieved some of the things that we were trying to achieve, which is making sure that people that did not need to be in a hospital were in the appropriate level of care. Now, the reduction of this program does not create, we do not believe it will create a backlog in our system. This program has been running about half full for the last 9 months now. The Wadena program, likewise, is running about half full. So by closing this program, we will still have that subacute capacity in our system. It'll simply be in Wadena. That does create a geographic problem for our people, because instead of having two sites geographically dispersed, we'll be operating one site. But we still believe that we can meet the needs of the folks coming to our door who need that subacute level of care.
Question? Welcome. We've had lots of talks about the whole state-operated services thing, and I don't mean to go very far into that. But so you're closing this one, moving something off of the old Wilmer campus, which will now be empty, or is there something left there?
Mr. Chair, the second part of this is to relocate the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital, which is a 16-bed acute inpatient hospital for serving children and adolescents with very specialized mental health needs, now located on the Wilmer campus. The Wilmer campus has actually been sold, so we're leasing space. The building that we're leasing is a three-story residential building, which doesn't lend itself well to hospital level of care. We work with it, but the space we would be moving to in the what is now occupied by the adult program is a space designed specifically as a hospital. So we're going to have better physical plant and treatment space than what is currently available. The cost, the savings, of course, will be that, the current lease structure for the CBHH, the Community Behavioral Health Hospital, will be accommodated by the movement of the CABS program from the campus to that community site. And the existing site is desirable for the people who bought the campus. Can't remember the name of the company, but it's not that important for this discussion. But they are in a biotech poultry business and are using it as a technology campus. The building that we'll be vacating is very desirable to them, so it works for them and it'll work for us.
And at the in memory of Representative Junkie, who would have been asking these questions, the city of Wilmer is happy with how this has all transpired. I know it was a big deal when with all the closings, and for the benefit of newer members, the whole changing of the state hospital system, I happen to have the last remaining one, has been quite a process. I'll leave it at that. And probably a necessary change, but it's just been very difficult to move through. So Wilmer is now probably pleased that this, they have a new building and it's a different program and they have their old site developed as a industry.
Mr. Chair, I can't speak for the city of Wilmer. We have had a conversation with them about the changes. We've also had a conversation with Candy, Ohio County, who actually owns the property and leases to us. And they are aware of the pressures that we're under, and they understand the changes, and they haven't voiced any great opposition.
Yeah. Okay. Any questions about that? I just have one more question since you're here, and you're probably going to disappear after the next page. The whole Meadow thing, maybe that's a different discussion we should have in my office, but I'm curious about that and the status, and that would be maybe fascinating for the members, but probably out of the context of today, so I'm interested in that sometimes. So maybe I'll call you back for that.
Okay, be happy to.
Thank you. Any other questions while Mr. Tesner is here? Oh, yeah. Ah, we have a question, Mr. Tesner. Representative Slaway.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, and I'm not that familiar with all of this, but so the children's unit is moving from one place in Wilmer to another place in Wilmer?
It is.
Okay. So is that where, Mr. Chair, where are most of the children's families? Do you track that? Are they from the Twin Cities?
We do. Most of the children that we serve, child and adolescent, and the families are from the Twin Cities, about 70%, and about 30% from the greater Minnesota area.
Mr. Chair, so has there been any thought to moving it to the Twin Cities? Are they not in need of seeing their families?
Mr. Tesner, now you can go ahead and make Wilmer unhappy, but Mr. Tesner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, ideally the service would be located as close to the families as possible to expedite that relation, the visitation and the collaboration with the team. As I had said earlier, the children and adolescents that we see have very complex mental health and physical health complications, and their stay with us is typically longer than what you'd see in a child and adolescent hospital in the cities because of that complexity. So it does place a burden on the families as well as the children. We're aware of that. The location in Wilmer initially was set legislatively. And we are working with families who in visitation and trying to expedite that and make it as comfortable as possible. At this point, we don't have space available to relocate it, but it is something that we're aware of the need.
Representative Slawy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that he said exactly what was my thinking. You know, and now they've opened, we all see those big billboards for the new adolescent facility, and I think it's Maple Grove or somewhere, and they're trying to get one in Woodbury. So I don't know if those are the same types of clients.
Mr. Tesner, why don't you just give us an orientation to that? That'd probably be just at least a 1 minute shot. That would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital, CABS, it's a 16-bed facility. It serves children and adolescents with a mental health diagnosis. Typically, they also have co-occurring complex medical conditions that interact with that diagnosis. It also serves kids and adolescents with neurocognitive impairments as well. So these are kids who have complex co-occurring things going on that typically other child and adolescent hospitals have not developed the expertise necessary to manage. When we established this hospital distinctively and it was sited at Wilmer, it kind of came out of a residential program and evolved into a hospital. We spent a great deal of time throughout the state talking with every other hospital advocacy groups, families, and consumers that had been through our system before, counties, other mental health providers, to try to get a sense of who should we really be targeting, and that's how we ended up with this very narrow, small slice. Nevertheless, as you're pointing out, the geography being far away from people, it does present a challenge.
And Mr. Tesner, this is only one of its kind in the state.
It is the only one.
I think I saw Representative Junkie's map, and Wilmer was right in the middle of the state, as I recall.
Mr. Chair, as I remember, it is actually in the middle of the state.
Anything else, Representative Slawy? And the new Prairie, what's it called? That's a psychiatric services and not so physically based, more psychiatrical. The new beds at Prairie, what's it called?
Prairie St. John.
Prairie St. John. Yeah. Is that right, Mr. Tesner?
That's my understanding.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Okay, well and we could do a whole day on this, which we're not going to do today. So. Thank you very much. You can leave while you can, I think. And I think you have one page left, do you, Commissioner?
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the final page was page 97, and it was the governor's proposal to extend coverage for tribal child placements. And this proposal is budget neutral, and as I understand it, it's tweaking legislation that was put into effect last year. And essentially it allows for when the tribal authority places a child in a mental health residential treatment service, they can now bill MA and get 100% reimbursement. So I don't know if there are any questions.
Any questions? Certainly.
I had one on a previous.
Oh, I'm sorry. We can bring Mr. Tesner back. So are we through on this one?
No, he was... I just got to point this out on page 94, the two bullet points. I've been here 19 years now, and I've never seen this language, but it's a chronically antagonistic significant other or an actively antagonistic significant other. So if you could have some explain the difference to those two
Commissioner, on page 94, do you know what we're talking about?
I do know what you're talking about, Mr. Chair, Representative.
Don't name any names, though, I think, if you're going to identify those individuals. But you want to try to, do you want to, is that a question?
That's fine, I'll pass.
Okay, this is kind of, do you want to, well,
Mr.
Go ahead and comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, thank you for passing. But we can get back to you on that if you'd like.
I think he just thought it was interesting, so it's curious at least.
I actually found that interesting, too, when I read it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was thinking of taking this page home and showing it to my wife.
I'll give her ideas.
That may or may not be a good idea. I think that's, thanks, Commissioner, for coming. Any last questions? Thank you very much, and
thank you.
I know you have other places to go, so thank you for giving us the time. Okay, Mr. Held and Ms. Bartolik, if you gained enough information about our mental health program, you can come and tell us about our continuing care. And while they're coming, Representative Huntley would like to make his presence known by moving the minutes.
I would move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of that?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thanks so much. Welcome back. And what page are we on now?
Mr. Chair, I was curious as to whether there were more questions on the surcharge page or if you had wanted to just move on to the remainder.
I think we exhausted that, but if anybody thought of any more questions about the surcharge. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Actually, just one question. If the surcharge were not captured, it would actually be a benefit to the nursing homes. Right, Mr. Held. If we didn't extract the money out, it could be spent for purposes that nursing homes would spend money for if we left the money in the system.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm not.
Well, we extracted some money, was taken away toward the deficit, right? In the, there was a net savings which the state captured, and so if that $21 million or whatever was left in there, that could be considered a COLA of some kind or other.
That $21 million could be returned to the general fund, Mr. Chair, or anywhere else that you would decide.
Right, again, but okay.
Is that what? Am I getting what you're?
That's fine. Yeah, that's. Go into the next page. It was not meant to be that hard of a question. So.
I believe that the next item that I'm supposed to respond to is the modify non-rate payments page on page 53. And this page consists of approximately five different elements, and those would be having to do with the plan closure rate adjustments, that the commissioner would not approve additional plan closure rate adjustments beginning July 1st, nor would the commissioner approve single bed incentive payments beginning July 1st, that on that same date, the enhanced rates for new admissions would be reduced from 20% to 10%. Those apply for the first 30 days. That the bed hold payments would be reduced from 60% to 30%, and a facility's eligibility to bill for bed hold days to Medicaid would change from a 93% occupancy test to a 96% occupancy test. And finally, that the amount of money that the Medicaid program pays for a single bed room in cases where there's documented medical necessity would be reduced from 11.5% to 5.5%.
And I suppose is there an itemization of what each of those different elements saves?
There's a fiscal note that specifically talks about I believe it's the gross savings on those, and then that one-page document that I gave you
Is that here? Okay.
Also gives us some quantification of this.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Thanks for anticipating the question. So it's on this one pager that you all have.
So the table
it's
in the middle.
Separate from the budget book, it's this one today.
The table in the middle kind of gives some gross numbers in terms of, for example, where it says PCRA, that's the plan closure rate adjustment. It's defined up above. The state currently has about $10 million in existing rates of plan closure rate adjustments. This does not affect those. Those would stay in place. But it gives you a scope of how big that is currently. The single bed incentives are currently about $4.7 million. and so forth. And then the table at the bottom on the left-hand column where it says effect on MA and private pay revenues shows you cumulatively for all nursing homes how much, what is the revenue impact of that specific element. So, for example, the PCRA is estimated to have a revenue reduction of $500,000 to facilities. We have no way to know who would be applying for them had it were to be continued, but that's what we estimate it would be for a year. The effect on the bed holds would be a revenue reduction of $3.2 million, enhanced rates $2.1 million, the single bed payments $12.3 million.
Any questions about this? Mr. Held, in the past, I remember when I was a freshman and so on, we were trying to downsize. We had too many beds, we said, and now I noticed in your notes that we're probably about the right size. Do you believe that this is the right number of beds to have for Minnesota? Is that what you're saying in that?
Mr. Chair, I'm not really making that point. If you look at the status of long-term care report that we discussed a couple weeks ago, I think it, in a more lengthy way, establishes what we're thinking about that. We're certainly closer to where we want to be. I think we still do have more beds than we need. We're about 20% higher than the national average in terms of beds per thousand for 65 and older, and we're slightly above if you calculate it on a beds per thousand for 85 and older. But because we're getting a lot closer, we were 91 beds per thousand. We're now down to about 51 beds per thousand. And because of the uneven distribution of beds between counties, the point that I'm trying to make there is that I think that there increasingly is a risk that there will be parts of the state where we will be having access problems, not for the state overall, but the consequence would be that people would have to travel quite a ways to get care. There's one county that you may be familiar with yourself. It's the lowest bedded county in the state, and that's Anoka. The highest bedded county state has six times as many beds per thousand.
Which is?
Wilkin.
Really?
Wilkin County.
Okay. And that's a function of population, I would imagine.
Well, it's on a beds per thousand elderly, right. So the bigger the population, the more beds we would expect to keep it level.
And this is a whole fascinating topic, too, but I don't want to spend too much time on it. But Representative Kiffmeyer, I'd like to ask a question.
Yes, as long as you're kind of opening up that subject, I just...
Only a little.
Just a little bit. Yes, I know it. Big, big.
I'm worried not to do that.
One of the things when I was on the hospital board and we put in an assisted living facility was an interesting phenomenon. We always thought we were opening up the facility for our local residents till we started getting reservations from all over the country. And indeed, people were moving to be closer to their children because the children often couldn't move, but the parents came to be closer to the children. So sometimes it's an interesting dynamic as far as you have elderly in your area, and you would think you would need to have those beds to take care of those elderly in your area. That is not always borne out by, such as we were. We filled them, it all took care, but not in the way we thought it would. Do you have any statistics or any numbers or information? Because I think that's an important concept to keep in mind.
Maybe the one-minute answer, and then if you want to get some data, we can take
it. I don't think I can even take a minute because I don't have any statistics on people from other states coming to Minnesota. Less than a minute.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I wasn't meaning other states. I meant within our state even.
We do know that the migration from one county to another, for whatever the reason might be, is different by county. And so one of the things that we think is worthy of analysis and is discussed in that report is what we call out-migration. And that's where a person, when you look at all the people from a given county who are in nursing homes, how many of them had to go to a nursing home outside of that county? In the next week or two, you'll probably hear me.
By need or by choice is what I was saying, because sometimes it's by choice. We shouldn't assume.
That's exactly right. It could be that they're choosing to be near their kids, and it could be that there's not a bed available.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If you want to, I'm just nervous about getting through all these things. If we can come back to this at the end, if it's, I didn't mean to provoke the big discussion. I have two people with questions, Epson Liebling and McDonald. If it's really short, we can do it, but otherwise I'm nervous we're going to spend the whole time on long-term care, which we can do and then do some more of this next week, I guess.
Well, thanks, ahead, Mr. Epson Liebling. I don't think this will be very long. I just wanted to say, you know, this is a really interesting topic. I'd like to know a lot more about it because often we hear people saying, I think, and without any data, and in fact, we've asked and there have been studies and it's without any data, we hear people saying that people move to Minnesota for our generous welfare benefits. And I wonder, you know, when we're talking about, you know, welfare benefits, clearly there's not the data to support that. I mean, we've heard that in previous years. I know many of you new people haven't heard those presentations, but we've heard that from the Department of Human Services, that the data does not support that. However, I wonder, you know, when we talk about welfare, we're usually talking about some kind of cash benefits, but here we're talking about people who whose nursing home care is very often funded by medical assistance dollars, half of which is, of course, state dollars. And that is a huge part of our budget, as we know. So I'd be really interested to know, to the degree to which people are moving to Minnesota and then taking advantage of, and I don't mean taking advantage in an exploitive way, because, you know, obviously if someone's children live here, it makes perfect sense to move to be close to your children when you start to need care in your later years. But I'd just be curious about the trend in that regard, if there's any data on that, you know, because clearly this is a big cost driver in our budget.
They're moving here for our nursing homes. That's okay, Representative Held, that's an interesting question. I've never even thought of it. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair,
take 30 seconds, all the time you want.
I have heard that sort of urban myth too, and I suspect there's truth to it in some areas. I have never heard of anybody moving to Minnesota because we pay our nursing homes so well.
I
think the notion that they're coming here because their kids are here is would be the reason, and that probably goes both ways.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Held, I just had a question on your last bullet point where it says the payments for the beds will be reduced from 11.5 to 5.5, and then that this change will result in medical assistance receiving residents losing access to private rooms. So my question is it more expensive to have a resident in a single bed room or their own private room, or more cost effective to have a double occupancy?
We currently pay 11.5% of whatever the rate is in that facility as an add-on if there's medical necessity for a single bedroom, so it's more expensive. However, one could do a more global evaluation of what are the effects on the whole population of single bedrooms, and the notion of having to deal with roommate problems and the agitation that comes from those kind of problems and relocating people and figuring out who goes with who. There's a lot of cost to sharing rooms, too.
Mike,
just as a general principle.
Yeah. Thank you. You have another page to talk about?
I don't believe I do.
Okay. All right. And
the list that I was given just had that. Is there anything else?
Well, there would be if we let you, but we're going to cut you off. So maybe if there's time at the end, we can take more questions about this. I mean, this is a topic we all care about. It's close to all our heads and hearts. So who's next? Healthcare.
Mr. Chairman, while they're coming, if I could just add a little
by
bit
all
of
means,
interest.
Add an interesting point.
Yes. As I visited about 125 nursing homes, one of them that I found was most interesting, they were in the process of converting to all single rooms. Interesting enough, they ended up changing their plan due to the residents. There are some people that actually really enjoyed it, and they actually started creating some four-bed kind of cluster areas because they didn't want to be alone. They wanted to be with their friends. It's not a bad thing. So sometimes what we think is an ideal situation of being alone in a situation isn't necessarily true for everybody. Just a thought.
Well, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Scott Lights, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. The first page that we have is page 62. The Medical Assistance Electronic Health Records Incentives page. Mr. Chair, this is an initiative that would allow for the implementation of payments to providers for the adoption and implementation of electronic health records. The federal American Recovery and Reinvestment Act put in place an incentive program to enable hospitals and healthcare providers to put EHRs in place. It provided 100% federal funding to do that, and then allowed for 90% state, the federal match, 10% state match for the implementation of those payments. There are Medicare incentive payments and Medicaid incentive payments. The federal government will be administering the Medicare payment side. State Medicaid programs have responsibility for administering the Medicaid payments. So this initiative is asking for funding to be able to implement those payments to providers for their adoption and meaningful use of electronic health records.
Mr. Leitz, if we didn't do this, would the revenues not flow, or would they have to meet their own match?
I missed the last part of your question.
Oh, would they have to, if we didn't pay the match, who would, and would the money not come if we didn't pay it as a state cost?
Mr. Chair, the payments have to be made through the state Medicaid agencies, and so we would need to, the funding that's being requested here is really to allow us to do the payments to those providers and to track those payments in compliance with the federal government.
And what impact is $4 million going to make on the ocean of costs in this matter? Can you tell me what dent this makes?
Mr. Chair, the payments that will be going out to the providers will be around a little bit south of $200 million in incentive payments. What that will allow them to do is to put in place electronic health records, meaningfully use them, which means they have to be able to, over a period of time, exchange information about patients for the purposes of treatment, with the goal of being able to coordinate that care across multiple types of clinics and providers. And so the overall aim here is that the investment is relatively modest up front. The payoff over time and decreased use of things like ERs and better coordination of care and fewer pharmaceutical interactions.
I just meant this piece because it's a 10% match, so it must match $4 million.
Correct.
On this little piece. And so, I mean, it seems like it's a... This is a small part of the $200 million, but is this going to a specific array of some hospitals someplace or a bunch of little clinics? Or
Mr. Chair, the request in the budget, if I'm understanding your question correctly, the request that's here is really for the administrative portion of administering the program.
Oh, it is.
At the DHS.
Okay, Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier, I happen to tune in to exchange of information. Could you please tell me what kind of privacy information is being shared?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, in accordance with state law, what providers in the state are able to do with patient consent is to exchange information for the purposes of treatment between providers. So, for example, if a patient is seen at a clinic and then needs to be referred to another clinic, state law requires that patient consent before their information is exchanged. The way that's currently typically done is in a paper-based or fax-based system. What electronic health records enable to occur, again, with patient consent, is for that information to flow more directly from provider A with consent to provider B, only for the purposes of treatment of that patient.
Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And testifier, what if somebody were not to consent?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if information is shared without consent, there are statutory penalties for that. I don't know those. I'm not an expert in this area with regards to this. This is really about the incentive piece of it. But there are statutory safeguards and laws that actually prevent that information from flowing. And providers who are out of consent are liable for damages in that case.
President Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Franson was getting at, what if the patient does not sign, and I believe this is the HIPAA, correct?
Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, will probably fairly rapidly get beyond my explicit knowledge of HIPAA versus what the state laws are. I know our state laws do extend beyond what the HIPAA requirements are. HIPAA is a piece of it, but we also have specific laws that relate to when and if patient information can be shared between providers for the purposes of treatment. And it does require a patient consent in this case, or in our cases.
And members, this is a hour-long discussion going on this one, and it may be germane at some point. If you want to do one more question, Mr. Kiffmeyer, I mean, because it's this is just a huge discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I won't ask for any more information. I'll wait for another time. However, I want to clarify, because your answer keeps going a different direction. The answer that we're saying is, and don't answer it now, what if the patient does not sign that consent? Okay, so that's the question I'm looking for. What if they do not sign? I'm not asking the question, if they do sign, what is the privacy? What if they do not sign? You can answer it another time.
And I think that we'll try to arrange some time for this between my committee and Representative Gottwald's. Because I think this is a topic that it's worth the discussion. I have one more question on this page. So we're paying 10% match to us. And so we're getting 90% from the feds, and we pay the 10 to us. So if I don't put this in my budget to take from us, to give it to us, is this really a bookkeeping thing? Can I, like, take it back from us to make it a zero thing when I do my budget? Can I charge the I can charge the department 10% of just something, right? I can cut you 10% and then get back the 10% for free? Is that...
Mr. Chair, obviously, for us to find matching funds to be able to draw down federal funds, we have to have an appropriation to do that, and that is what's being requested in this page.
But sometimes in, like, the surcharges, we, you know, give money and then take it back, and so... I'll be thinking. I mean, otherwise I got to find another $400,000 for you guys to. You just make my job harder all the time, Mr. Lights. Thank you for that. on that cheery note, you want to take another shot at a different page?
sure, Mr. Chair. Page 64, which is the next item. Right now, the state operates two different eligibility systems. The primary health care programs that we run are Medical Assistance of Minnesota Care. And they're processed using two different systems. The first is MAXIS, which is an eligibility system that's used for the medical assistance program. It also supports a number of other programs. And then the Medicaid Management Information System, or MMIS, is how we pay claims, but it also stores eligibility information for Minnesota Care. Currently, the system that the county workers use and others who assist in enrollment is cumbersome because of the two systems that we have. It requires paper entry in certain cases, and it requires that a number of things that have been built into the systems over time be worked around. What is being proposed here is a development and installation of a more streamlined eligibility system that would work with our two current back-end eligibility systems. So we have MAXIS and MMIS. This would really serve to be a front-end that would make eligibility determination much easier for our programs in the state. This is also something that would be an elimination or a reduction in the burden that we currently have on our county caseload workers who do a lot of the enrollment work on behalf of the medical assistance program. So the goal here, again, is to streamline that process, make it easier for determination of eligibility to occur. I might add just one more thing, Mr. Chair. Again, this is an opportunity for enhanced federal funding. This is a 90% match. What's being requested here is is essentially the state share to update those eligibility systems. It's 90% through 2015, and then 75% enhanced after that point.
Representative, help me.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Lights, how does this fit in with the exchange where the eligibility is going to be done in the future?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, the aim here would very much be to make our programs and determination for those programs streamlined in advance of the exchange, with the expectation it would work with the exchange. So the goal here is really to line those two up.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lights, this is a topic that I'm extremely interested in. Hear from my county a lot, in several counties, just about our eligibility verification system and how far behind we are in a lot of other states, and the cost associated, and have also, you know, realized that a huge part of that is just the complexity of our programs, as is displayed by this enormous book in front of us. And so I am just curious And I guess I need to read through this a little bit more, maybe, or somewhere else in the book, but has the governor also alluded to proposals for simplification of our programs? I know in other states, it's from, you know, who I've talked to, it's almost impossible to get an effective system before you do some major simplification of programs. If you look at other states where they've been successful, that's been the precursor. So does the governor have any proposals or thoughts as to, or willingness to a severe amount of simplification to our complex programs in order to have a successful integrated eligibility system?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, you're correct that we do have a complicated system right now. And it's been built that way over a series of years as new eligibility categories or special categories have been added over time. And it has made systems such as this more difficult to put in place. There has been a lot of progress in how these systems can work as front ends relative to where we were maybe 7 or 8 years ago. I think we're actively examining areas that we may be potentially be able to make some initial steps at this on simplification piece. We don't currently have a number of those within the budget, but we're taking a look at that right now as potential moving forward. And we do recognize that, especially as we move forward towards more fully implementing some of the things in the state health reforms that were passed in 2008 and 2007, as well as looking forward, that there's likely to be additional streamlining and simplification that likely needs to occur. We're open to obviously hearing about those as well. So we look forward to having those discussions.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lights. That's good to know, and something that I would be open to conversations about. Been in touch with some folks in the department, and they have been helpful. But to me, with this amount of money in a difficult time like this, plus the 90% federal match, you know, wanting to set ourselves up to be successful in this, I don't think we have much more time to waste with a program like this that we're in desperate need of. And a lot of these costs really fall on our counties who are dealing with the archaic eligibility verification system we currently operate under. So thank you for the information.
And members, hopefully our simplification study group will come up with something to make it easier. Mr. Lights, I don't know if you mentioned it, what would it cost to, like, I was talking to one of your programmers who I guess we're using COBOL, which I remember was something that I remembered from, like, early college years, which dates me, unfortunately, that was kind of novel. That was new then. So if we were going to do the whole thing to make it right, what are we looking at?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific number for that. I think you raise what is a legitimate and good question. I think around kind of what we're talking about here is really more of a front end that works with the systems that we have. There is a broader question. It's not addressed within the governor's budget here, but I think it's a broader question that we need to ask around the systems that do our MMIS and our MAXs are old. They're antiquated. They do their functions, and they are programmed, as you said, in some older languages. So it's a question we need to explore, and we need to look at that piece of it. I don't have a specific number. We can do some looking and see what that might look like, though.
Well, it just seems prudent that we should be thinking about that. I mean, when every student, I have a 12-year-old who has an iPod, which probably has more computing capacity than some of the things that we use. We could hire him. Actually, he'd figure it out for us. it just seems like, I don't know why it's so hard. I know we try to build our own stuff, which doesn't always work real well. And isn't there some off-the-rack thing that they sell in New York or somewhere that, in my little clinic, we send it off to a clearinghouse. We have a little computer, and it's some normal thing that, it's not a fancy one. We send it off to a clearinghouse, and then they send it off to wherever. And it all kind of works, you know, and just wondering, I mean, and you have I talked to your new fellow who's on the team there who seems very bright, and I probably beyond today's hearing, but I'll let you react, and I've got McDonald and Murphy's.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. As you can tell by looking at the budget page, we're talking about a $50 million investment over the next 4 years, and as Representative Mack mentioned, our programs are very complicated, and that's one of the reasons why this seems so difficult, is that it is a very complicated system, and fixing it's going to be very complicated, especially when you've got 800,000 people you need to continue to support on the program while you're fixing it. It takes quite an investment.
Well, I think we're interested in at least tell us what the sticker is going to be. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Leitz, just a question on regarding that. So this particular suggestion is to incorporate and design and develop a brand new system to streamline eligibility determine qualifications. Does it overhaul the MAXIS and the MMIS, MMIS as well? Or is it just you're incorporating and developing a brand new system and not doing anything to enhance the current two that we have?
Yes. Mr. Leitz.
Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald, the system itself, and this is pertains to some of the discussion with the chair as well that we just had, this system really works with what's existing in place, and puts the front end to those to make the determination piece easier, but it works with the existing systems. There is a broader question here about the existing systems and work that probably over time needs to be done there as well.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is not a new issue for our committee, as you know.
No.
And I think it was 2 years ago we were working on a couple of pieces of policy to try and simplify the policy side in preparation for future simplification of the automation. So I have a thick file, and Representative Mack and I talked together just a little bit about this, but the policy questions embedded in this divided Democrats and Republicans, the legislature and the administration, and the House and the Senate, the different policy questions embedded in there. And that's why I think you have to do the policy simplification first, but there are a lot of hard questions embedded in there about what the result of the simplification means. And we were not able to overcome those differences a couple of years ago, but I hope that we can, working together, make some progress on that now while we have this opportunity and some willingness from the administration.
Thanks. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on the subject of some of these areas of IT and their conversions, I have some experience going from COBOL to modern languages. And three major systems, paper, microfiche, reel-to-reel, COBOL, every one of them. Paper records since 1954, critical to the business structure of Minnesota. So having that kind of experience, the really issue here is conversions and running two systems during that time. There are times when you have these databases and sometimes you start out with a front engine so that the consumer, the customer, and then afterwards you do the backside, and I mean there's a couple of ways to do that, but absolutely it is hugely complex, takes a lot of time, and there's a tremendous amount of risk that should be carefully assessed. So I not so much I disagree with your front end approach and understanding that, but I do think that there are other committees that deal more with the specifics, so I'm sure they'll get into that. But I just wanted to weigh in as the fact that this is complex with risk and challenging and takes a lot of time.
And this has caught all our interest. It's interesting how these, one-page things provoking, which is why we brought them back now to have a little more relaxed time. And I don't think we'll quite get through the list today, although maybe we'll get lucky. But I don't want to cut discussion short. You might want to, as you think about this internally, think about what paybacks there come with, staffing and training, and they keep telling us that computerization will give us more staff flexibility. I remember when we computerized our office, they said the staff would have time to clean the bathroom, so we hired a whole other full-time person. That's how well it worked for our improvement. and the bathrooms still weren't clean. we had to hire that separate. But there must be some future costs with staff and state employees and county burden and harm to providers that lose along the way, and that would be an add back to the savings end of it, which could generate at least leverage some incremental monies to help it. So I think we're interested in that. So not that we're going to design it in this committee, absolutely not, but we just see it as a challenge. Anyway, so think we've exhausted that topic. You can. Oh wait, Representative Slawick. Oh. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, just to one last comment on the issue is we have looked at a lot of this over the last couple of years, and one thing is the child care system, and that's wrapped into all of this eligibility. And then they bought a new system, as you guys know, called MEC Squared, to do then the payment information. And then Representative Franzen and our group have been talking about the waiting lists, and the waiting lists still don't interact with either of those systems, and so we can't track the waiting list well, and it's just crazy, because that's one thing we'd like to focus on is potentially how to the underspending and how to get on top of that, and then you have to get on top of the waiting list, and that means you have to have a good waiting list, and the computer can't track it. So I just, that's like a third layer of, you know, you have the Maxis system, the MEC squared, and then the waiting list. So I just hope you'll look at that when you look at it all as well.
Okay, well, you're encouraged now. Well, the job would be hard. Solve that by next week, would you? Okay, if you want to continue on to your next page.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 65, and this is a series of reforms to the managed care contracting that we do for delivery of services for enrollees in our health care programs. Since 1985, we've used managed care arrangements to deliver both health care and some long-term care services to people enrolled in Medicaid, in the Minnesota Care Program, and other programs. And what this does is to add some reforms to that area as we have started to look at how we do our contracting and areas that we can potentially do some things differently or better. This identifies four areas that we're suggesting as part of the budget we look at. The first is to right now, we do contract withholds with the managed care plan. So payments go out, but a portion of that of the capitation payments that we pay to health plans are withheld from the contracts. And then we have certain performance measures that we measure them against. Some are clinical, some are administrative, and if they meet those targets, some or all of that money is paid back to the plans. What this suggests is adding a new clinical performance measure, which is targeted at reducing hospital readmission rates. Basically, what we're requesting in the page is that that addition of the clinical target would be a 5% reduction in 30-day hospital readmissions rates over a series of years, over the next 5 years, until the readmission rate is reduced by 25% from the base rate of what it was in 2010. So basically, hospital readmissions are something that, if properly managed on the front end, once people leave the hospital, that's a way to reduce healthcare costs by eliminating or reducing those readmissions. So that's a measure that we're suggesting be added. The second is to establish a competitive bidding pilot for managed care contracts for adults and children in the Twin Cities metro area. The way that we do procurement right now is that we have state-set managed care rates. Managed care plans then work to essentially within that set rate, that's a capitation rate that they receive for delivering services. It's a state set rate. What we're suggesting here is a change on a pilot basis in the Twin Cities Metro to more of a competitive bidding structure, where plans would then, instead of having a state set rate, they would actually be bidding the rate that they would be suggesting for providing services to our enrollees. It's a way to create more price competition within that rate setting process. The third area relates to the administrative costs that plans are allowed under our programs. Right now, there's a cap of 6.6% in our managed care plans, that portion of their capitation rate that can be used for administration. We're proposing to reduce that portion from 6.6% down to 5.3% within the budget. And then lastly is a non-administrative reduction, which is basically a 2.5% reduction in the payment rate that health plans receive for delivering services to our Medicaid clients.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Lights, been a lot of talk recently in the New Yorker and some other journals and on TV about individuals that are continually showing up in hospitals, and nobody seems to pay attention to that. And is there anything that we can do to encourage the plans or somebody to figure out how you identify those people and figure out better ways to treat them?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, a couple things on your question. The first is that I think as we continue to build out the medical home concept, that will over time have an impact on doing reductions there. The second is in the area of as we develop, as the legislature gave the department authority last year to develop accountable care organizations and think about different ways that we actually pay providers to encourage them to better manage folks in their accountable care organization. There will be a built-in incentive to avoid people showing up at ERs or in the hospitals when they don't need to. The third area on the rehospitalization piece that's in the budget here, I think, is really focused on as people leave the hospital, that hospitals are incented and plans are incented to work with hospitals around ensuring that they are given proper follow-up, that they understand discharge instructions, and that there are systems in place for them to ensure that those people don't get infections or have complications as a result of the surgery. So I think there's a number of areas that we're trying to address that are under existing law, and then with the addition of this additional budgetary item.
Gibson, help me. I've quoted your question a number of times. What's their incentive to save any money? And I think there's the carrot and this is the stick, and I think if they won't do it voluntarily, then they're going to be forced to. Did you have a follow-up question?
Well, I was going to just a comment that, I mean, the hospital service, they know who these people are. But you do get into the privacy issues. The ambulance service. They know. They're hauling these people in constantly. And so the information's out there, and somebody knows it. The question is, how do we improve the health care of these people?
Representative Huntley, I think the plans know it, and I think the hospitals, they probably have a frequent flyer card they could, because hey, welcome back, you know. And I think that the example of the CCDS has only until they're forced to do something to deal with this question do they find themselves able to grapple with it. And they found a good answer. I'm sure you visited the Hennepin County place where they have reduced readmissions remarkably by deciding that they wanted to, you know, that they had no choice but to. Anyway, other comments about this or this piece? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just think that there were a lot of lessons learned with the CCDS, and some good and some not so good. So
you want to elaborate
the whole table? Well, there were a lot of people that were left out of the system altogether. And there was a lot of denial of care because, documented denial of care because the decision was being based on financing. So providers, you know, when we toured the state, they said, well, we're not going to see any new people if they weren't already in our panel because they weren't a part of our system before and we can't afford to do now. So denying based on inability to pay, and also providers making decisions about certain care, the care they're going to provide or not provide based on ability to pay. And some of that's appropriate and some of it's not. So I think, you know, there were good lessons and difficult lessons and some things we shouldn't repeat as we move forward. That's all.
I gave you a chance to say it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Other questions or comments? You get to move on, I guess. So, thanks.
Mr. Chair, the next page is page 67, which is the evidence-based childbirth program. And this relates to elective inductions prior to 39 weeks gestation. And what we know from the medical evidence is that elective inductions have been associated with many of unintended consequences, including risk of complications, and a much higher risk of complicated cesarean deliveries. Looking at that evidence, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists recommended that elective inductions not be performed before 39 weeks of gestation. And what this proposal does is to put in place a series of incentives, soft incentives, I would call them, more policy incentives, not financial incentives, to encourage hospitals to adopt policies that would not that would lead to fewer elective inductions prior to 39 weeks of gestation. And so the main thing, Mr. Chair, is that providers who perform deliveries in hospitals without policies in place would basically be subject to some additional reporting that those who have policies in place would not be. And we believe that would provide an incentive for those hospitals to really establish those policies and hopefully over time reduce the number of inductions. And and as a result, we're able to book some savings as a result of that.
Mr. Lights, what if we just refuse to pay for any that were done before 39 weeks? What would that say? Can you find out?
We can look at that, Mr. Chair.
I mean, just seems to me, and I'll try to not editorialize away a lot, but there's some things we know are good ideas, and everybody agrees on them. And then to hope that they comply with these good ideas, I just think is a little, it's just interesting, especially in the times that we're facing now where we're making some of the really very challenging choices. So that's just anybody else wants to talk about it, that's my question, and just a comment. Maybe you can wait in fiscal notes some language I come up with if you want. So, anybody else want to talk about this? Representative Huntley.
Yeah, just a question, Mr. Chair, for Commissioner Lights. Is this the hospital's responsibility, or is it the OBGYN physician that may not be employed by the hospital?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair, I think it would be the hospital's responsibility to work with that referring physician to, with the physician who would be doing the delivery to really, and their policies that they put in place would really address that issue. So we're really looking at it at the hospital level. I think that has to be a relationship and a discussion as part of the policies that they'd be developing, which would then work with that physician.
Mm-hmm. Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Lights, just a comment. It just seems like it's another way that the government is getting in the way, although I do agree that C-sections aren't always the best way to go, but just another thing the government's trying to get their hands into, and I disagree.
Representative Giffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Lights, on the subject of evidence-based childbirth program. I think what we're looking at here is, does the evidence support that it's good care? And certainly in hospital policies or physician medical practices, this is a very relevant issue for them to study, to look at, and to consider, because this is increasingly becoming a problem, and evidence shows that provoking birth prior to the baby being ready and the mother being ready is not good for either of them. So I think it is appropriate to do this, but usually it is the physician who makes the final decision within the scope of the hospital policy. So I think, Representative Huntley, it's a hospital policy, but most of the time, even within the hospital, if the doctor says, it's what happened. So I think we would have to do both, not put all this on hospitals. I think it would be very important for us to take a look at our provider situations, but I think it should be evidence-based and should be studied. There are those times I've held a one-pound baby born prematurely in my hand, and it was not the choice of either the mother, the hospital, or the doctor. Those things are happening there, and so I wouldn't want to penalize anybody unfairly if that truly is a situation. We're talking about those where evidence shows it is not healthy for anybody. Thank you.
I think you can move on to probably our last page for today. The rehab one, is that?
Yeah, I can cover that one.
Okay.
Next is on page 69, and this deals with our prior authorization process and rehab services. This proposal has a number of provisions in it. Just as a little background, we pay for about 80,000 prior authorizations each year through our fee-for-service programs. And what this proposal would do is, first of all, it would modernize our prior authorization system. Right now, we use a paper system that where we have our vendors review each time we need a prior authorization, send it into them, and it's rather a time-consuming process to get those finished. The second step is to, effective July 1 of 2011, we will no longer, well, let me step back, actually. Effective March 1 of 2012, any provider requesting authorization, except those requesting for out-of-state services, must submit their prior authorizations electronically through our DHS Minute system. And also starting March 1 of 2012, the rehab services that we pay for and give prior authorizations for will no longer be subject to one-time service thresholds. In other words, service thresholds for a particular type of service. Instead, what they'll be based on is prior authorizations for an episode of treatment. And that gets at whether people who may need different types of services to treat their condition can get a prior authorization for that episode of service rather than for a particular type of service. One of the ways in which there's a couple ways in which this improves our process. First of all, by submitting the prior authorizations electronically, we're able to use an algorithm to review the prior authorizations and make quicker determinations about what we can authorize without having to go through sort of the lengthy paper process. The other thing that, in one way this improves the process for people. It's quicker, it's we're doing things electronically. We're not spending money on our vendors to do the paper process when we don't really need them necessarily to do that for the simpler processes. This also will improve the experience for clients because they, like I said, they'll get a prior authorization for a particular episode of treatment, so that if they, for some reason, their provider decides that to treat a particular condition they need to switch treatments or switch services, they can stay within that same prior authorization and get the services. They can also switch between providers. In other words, it's kind of a patient-centered prior authorization as opposed to a provider or service-centered prior authorization.
Mr. Greenman, I think we're going to finish this up next time.
Okay.
And actually, I have quite a few questions about this, at least a number. And just to help, I think you're coming back on Thursday. Next week. So let me just give people the thanks. We could have flown through these, but we purposely just took our time and had some good side discussion. Let me just announce what's happening next week. On Tuesday, we're going to forecast comes out on Monday. On Tuesday, we're going to hear 20-some witnesses that we had quite a good supply of witnesses that are coming. I'm hoping they don't come back on my bill. So we'll maybe if you're already here, we'll say we heard what you had to say. that'll cut down my list. So it'll be a one-pass system. Anyway, we'll have Mr. Hoffman come and discuss the forecast on Tuesday. I'm not sure if he knows that yet. Okay, and then on Wednesday, I think we're not meeting. So you can, at this point, plan Wednesday to do something else. And then Thursday, we're going to finish up the budget pages. We have a couple bills, and that will be the end of the governor's budget. And we also want to hear, there's a grant that the department got. We want to learn about the continuing care grant. And that's it for next week. So enjoy the weekend. We're adjourned. Thank you. Oh, wait, Representative Huntley.
I have just a comment for Mr. Held, who's walking over there. I think it was you or some of your staff who prepared this sheet. And it's very useful to put all these things on one page instead of so it's much easier for us to understand when we get things like this.
So I think issues that are going to be discussed further, long-term care, data privacy, and what was the other thing we were saying? Oh, computerization. Representative Murphy, you get the last
thank
word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if you know when to anticipate getting the language for the governor's budget.
Anybody know when March 1st, language of the governor's budget is coming, so we can admire the Huntley bill. With that,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, we're adjourned.